This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 98 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today we'll be discussing Gnosticism, esoteric writing, and secret societies in Star Trek. Zachary, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Are you excited about this topic? I came up with this topic kind of on a whim. It's a little outside my comfort zone. I hope you're excited about it.
I'm very excited about it. It's fascinating. I have this love affair with secret societies and secret knowledge, and so this will be fun because it does exist in the Star Trek universe. Maybe more so than what we realize because they keep it a secret.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's a secret. How would we know, right? No, seriously, I thought this would be a good topic for Metatrex, partially because it has to do with something I'm reading about in philosophy right now, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But I figure that with your background in theology, that you might have something to say about Gnosticism and esoteric writing and some of these theological concepts that maybe you'd be better prepared to identify in Star Trek than I would.
I think it'd be fun because I think generally speaking in the Star Trek universe, after all, the whole premise of Star Trek is going out and exploring strange new worlds and seeking out new life and new civilizations. It's all about the gathering of knowledge. It's about expanding the horizons of human knowledge. And so I think really this is at the heart of what Star Trek is all about.
Well, Star Trek is a product of its time, and it was born in the mid-20th century, which is, I would call, the culmination of the modern period in philosophy. So things like progressivism, things like free and open exchange of information, things like the teleological, cumulative, progressive quest for knowledge and the way in which knowledge can improve society. Star Trek was committed to this idea that if we get as much knowledge as possible, go out in the universe, meet new people, share our knowledge with them, and they share their knowledge with us, that'll bind us all together. But it was all premised on this notion that knowledge is supposed to be public and open and accessible and not hidden and not secret and not have some sort of hidden cult-like nature to it. And yet in the history of philosophy, that's actually the minority view. For centuries and centuries and centuries, you could plausibly say that most philosophers, no matter what public stuff they were writing, held on to the core of their worldview in secret. You know, whether it was Plato's Academy or Aristotle's Lyceum, there was kind of an inner circle to philosophy, and their view is generally that if you gave knowledge to the masses, that was actually more corrupting because they weren't prepared to handle the full import of being that conscious and that self-aware and having that sort of hidden philosophical knowledge if they weren't sort of prepared to deal with it. Would it actually make their lives worse? And I think the same thing is probably true from your point of view in Christian theology. I mean, Jesus spoke in parables, but he didn't tell the full gospel out there in public. He told everything to his real message to his disciples in private. So even from the earliest days of Christianity, things like Neoplatonism and Gnosticism aside, there was kind of an inner core, an inner circle amongst Jesus and his disciples. So from the very beginning, there was some sort of Gnosticism or esoteric knowledge or some sort of secretiveness about beliefs, if only from a defensive standpoint, right? You know, early Christians were worried about being martyred. So that accounts for a lot of it for the first couple hundred years of Christianity. But I think that what's interesting is we don't really appreciate that this has been an important part of culture for thousands of years. Across the centuries, it was normal to have some sort of secretiveness to your special knowledge. If you were a doctor, 2,000 years ago, you didn't tell everyone how to cure people. You kept that knowledge to yourself. It was a secret Gnostic kind of knowledge, a special knowledge that you had, with all the power that goes along with having that special knowledge. And it's really only in the last 200 or 300 years that we've embraced the idea that knowledge should be free and public and open, and that when people write something, that they're telling you the straight scoop, that they're not hiding something. They're not hiding some alternative version that they're not contradicting themselves in public or in private, that you're getting the straight scoop when you read something someone has written. Mm-hmm. But actually, in the history of human thought, that is the minority view. The things people write and say in public are often, most of the time, very different than from their private beliefs. And what's interesting is drawing these connections from my point of view, looking for things that philosophers are doing to write esoterically, to disguise and mask their message. It's like the way Socrates never really answered a question directly, right? If you read all of Plato's dialogues, Socrates never answered any questions. He was just always, asking questions in turn. But the end result is that you really can get a sense of what Socrates believed, even though Socrates never says it. It's very hand-wavy, because it was dangerous to be a philosopher and dangerous to be a Christian in the first couple hundred years of Christianity. So all of these literary and linguistic mechanisms evolved, what's now known as esoteric writing, they evolved as a way of either masking your real beliefs or making those real beliefs accessible without saying them explicitly. And that's a fascinating alternative view of the history of philosophy, to look at all of philosophy as a kind of public versus private dichotomy, where the norm is that every philosopher is putting a false front on, or at least trying to obfuscate what they believe for the sake of their public writings. And then, of course, the interesting question is, what did they really believe in private? What did Plato teach at his academy, or what did Aristotle teach in private with his students at the Lyceum? What did Jesus's disciples talk about in private that wasn't written down? That's where the interesting stuff is. And if that's a real dichotomy, that's fascinating. So I guess my question was, that started this whole discussion, was, if Star Trek takes for granted this notion that knowledge should be public and accessible, that when admirals say something in Star Trek, you're getting the straight scoop, or when captains give an order, that you're getting the straight scoop of about what the captain's intentions are, or when you're communicating with an alien race, that you're getting access to that alien race's really belief system. Is there any kind of subtext to the thing, dialogue and the discussions and the worldviews we see in Star Trek? Is there any kind of insincerity in Star Trek that lends itself to the things that people find attractive in Star Trek? Like, people are really drawn to this notion of Section 31, right? That's not a public-facing Starfleet. This is something that's secret, in private, not acknowledged, but the people who are in inner circle of Section 31 have a very different view of intergalactic relations and Federation society than what's commonly understood or commonly perceived or commonly discussed in Star Trek, in universe, in Star Trek society, right, in Federation society. So I'm reading this book on this very topic. And I don't give book recommendations very often, but I've become completely fascinated by this one. I'm not finished with it yet. I'm about halfway through. It's called Philosophy Between the Lines, The Lost History of Esoteric Writing. It's by an author named Arthur M. Meltzer. And he basically tries to rewrite all of the history of philosophy, going looking for and exposing the kind of esoteric writing that we tend not to believe in these modern times. When I read Aristotle, I tend to take Aristotle for granted. But he's saying, no. Throughout history, philosophers have tried to dodge and hand wave and say public things and say different things in private, partially for the sake of keeping themselves safe, partly pedagogically, just like Jesus used to do in talking in parables. But for a number of different purposes, the things philosophers write were not actually what they really meant in a lot of ways. And so he's trying to uncover a lot of this stuff. So I thought it would be a fun project to look at all of Star Trek and say, what are the cracks in Federation society? What are the false fronts that are put up? What are the things that people say that they don't really mean? What are the necessary parts of society that we don't like to acknowledge? knowledge, and just go looking for anything that very broadly fits in the category of Gnosticism, some sort of secret, preserved, special knowledge only privy to a few people, any kind of esotericism where people are saying something but meaning something different, in any form at all, any kind of secrecy, any kind of secret societies, and maybe any kind of mysticism as well, because you could put mysticism in with the Gnosticism category, mm-hmm. where, you know, if you have some sort of mystical practice that, you know, science doesn't acknowledge, or, you know, another religion or another race in Star Trek can't understand, that probably falls under the banner of Gnosticism as well. So really, we should be making a lot of fine-grained distinctions between these different topics, but I want to lump them all together and go looking for anything in Star Trek that fits in this category, just like the author of this book was going looking for anything that counts as esoteric or Gnostic or mystical or secret in all of the history of philosophy. I think it'll be a really fun project.
What's super interesting about this to me is, you're right, this whole premise of Star Trek is this idea of free and abundant knowledge, and it's knowledge for everybody. It's really expanding the horizons of the entire human race by going out and sharing our knowledge and getting knowledge. And I think that there's this naivety among human beings, especially in Enterprise, for instance, where, you know, there's just this free, happy, hey, you know, we're humans, we're from Earth, and, you know, here's where we live, here's a quasar map, we're just going to show you where we live. And we go out there and we find out that the rest of the universe, the rest of the galaxy is very much like our own Earth.
I'm so glad you mentioned Enterprise, and maybe by extension, First Contact, where we see the first contact between Vulcans and humans, because while that's true in Enterprise, you know, the Enterprise is going out there, they're on the frontier, they're expanding, they're exploring, they're kind of spreading knowledge, gathering knowledge. It's very Star Trek utopian. But the whole premise of Enterprise is that the Vulcans don't want humans to do that because they don't think humans are ready. Yeah. So, you know, the Vulcans are saying, you humans can't actually handle the truth of what it means to be an interstellar, you know, exploratory race out there amongst the other races. So Vulcans were Gnostic. They wanted to keep this sort of intergalactic travel and interstellar knowledge. They wanted to keep that to themselves. They didn't want to share technology with humans. They didn't want to see humans out there amongst the stars. They didn't think humans were ready for it. They were actively trying to block them from it. So that says to me that Vulcans at least have some sort of Gnostic view about knowledge, that you don't get to be an interstellar travel. You don't get to be a member of the interstellar community until you're ready. And even the Federation holds that view, right?
Right.
The Federation doesn't admit just anyone. They admit planets that are ready to join that community. They kind of keep that special knowledge and that special relationship to themselves until planets reach a certain stage of development, and only then are they admitted into the Federation and can join the community. So I guess what I'm saying is that the Star Trek worldview, as much as we'd like to say that it is utopian and it's about free information, it's about knowledge, it's actually very Gnostic at its core, because the Federation doesn't share its secrets very easily, and the Vulcans don't share their secrets very right. easily. And I suspect that if we go on and on and on, race by race by race, religion by religion by religion, empire by empire in Star Trek, that we'll find that free and open exchange of information is not actually the norm, even in the Federation. It's actually sure. more like Gnosticism and esotericism.
Yeah, and that's very much to the point that I was making. You know, we have this kind of proto prime directive in the Enterprise universe as a result of the Vulcans withholding that knowledge from us. They're holding onto this knowledge. They don't want us to just, you know, free and open, get the plans for how to build these advanced warp capable engines. And so as the Federation develops, the Federation as a whole takes on that mantle. We've got in the Star Trek universe, the prime directive. And what is the prime directive, Zachary?
We don't share our secrets.
We don't share our secrets. We're not going to just go out and, you know, tell the rest of the universe how we got to the, how we found them.
And I guess what I'm curious is how much this analogy holds, because there is an analogy to sort of Neoplatonist Gnostic societies in early Christianity. There's also an analogy to, in philosophy, I would say, to things like Plato's Academy or maybe the Pythagoreans, you know, the sort of mystical knowledge about mathematics and music that the Pythagoreans held, that it was cult-like. You know, if you weren't part of the inner circle, you didn't get access to that. This was a special knowledge that they thought they found. They didn't share with people at large. But like every cult or every religion or every group, every secret society has the things it tells in public about what it is and who they are and what they're doing together. Mm-hmm. And then there are the things they do in private. So I guess I'm curious whether this analogy breaks down. Because I think in all those instances, whether it's Gnosticism or whether it's Plato's Academy or whether it's, you know, Socrates kind of, you know, hand waving on the things he really believes, if that is a really strong kind of dichotomy between what you're saying you believe and what you really believe, in other words, if it's more like putting on a mask or putting on a false front, and you could run this analogy about any secret society. Like, what about the Freemasons? You know, the Freemasons say they do things, and then in private they have all the religious ceremonies that they do, right? Okay. Is there a really strong dichotomy? Do they contradict each other in some way? Is it literally a false front, or is it some watered-down version of what they really believe? That's not clear at all, and it probably varies from group to group to group. But I guess this is the question. If Vulcans put up a false front to humans in terms of saying, we've got this special knowledge, and we're going to relate to you, yeah, but we're not going to tell you the straight scoop. We're not going to let you be out there. We're not going to let you join us. There's some special thing they think they've got that only Vulcans are privy to. And the Federation is very much the same way, we just said, right? And the Federation says, you know, yes, we're here. We've got starships. We've got an interstellar society, but you're not ready to join us yet until you evolve for another couple hundred years or whatever. until you have eliminated nationalism on your planet, generally. This is a critique of nationalism, too. Is there any kind of falsity to the outward message that's being told versus the inner message that is discussed in private amongst members of the Federation or member races of the Federation? Just like, you know, the Pythagoreans wouldn't necessarily reveal what they're really talking about and interested in, you know, when they're putting their front out there, their public face on. Same thing with the Freemasons. I'm not sure if I'm phrasing this very well, but I guess I just wonder, is the public-facing view of the Federation, say in a first contact situation, is that a kind of mask that if you peel the mask back, there's a different message when you're part of the inner circle, when you're a member of the Federation?
Yeah. No, I think you're phrasing that fine. And for that matter, I think another interesting facet of that is that how does that stand up over time? Does it mean, for instance, in the 24th century, what it meant in the 23rd, even internally? For instance, the principles of the Federation. You know, anytime I think of the principles of the Federation, I think of Captain Janeway. You know, she is this ambassador of Federation principle in the Delta Quadrant, and she's all the time waving her finger, talking about Federation principle. And I'm not saying that to criticize her. I'm just saying she's very dogmatic in the way that she holds on to these Federation principles. But are the Federation principles she's holding on to the same principles that existed 100 years earlier, or for that matter, you know, 200 years earlier, when the foundation of the Federation was put in place?
Janeway, I almost more than Captain Kirk and more than Picard, I would say Janeway is a straight shooter. I get the sense 99.99% of the time with Captain Janeway, you're getting the straight scoop from Captain Janeway. She's not hiding anything. She's not putting up a false front. She's not withholding information. She's just telling you how it is. And I think Kirk will kind of strategize a bit more. And Captain Picard is actually very, you know, he kind of keeps his secrets to himself. He's happy to discuss it in the observation lounge, but he puts on a very public front when he's negotiating or when he's, you know, being ambassadorial.
Positively.
Or in a first contact situation. It's all very contrived, right? Janeway, not so much. Janeway's just, you know, we're here and we're on this mission and, you know, we have these values and we're trying to get home and, you know, it's you get the straight scoop. But even Janeway has her captain's eyes only moment. I'm thinking of the Omega Directive, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, there are certain things that are for captain's eyes only that anyone below is not privy to. And so if they come up in conversation, hey, what's this weird Omega that just showed up on the screen? You know, all of a sudden Captain Janeway is in Gnostic mode, right? Where there's this special dangerous knowledge in the case of the Omega molecule that is not for anyone's eyes except for captains and above. And so, again, this is just another example of, you know, even the Federation, even your most straight shooter captains in Starfleet have certain things that are for captain's eyes only that if you confront them about it, you might get an answer, but you're not going to get the straight answer.
Well, I'm glad you used that example, Zachary, because it kind of goes to the question that I was asking. And it creates, interestingly enough, some different tensions. There's a tension that exists in that episode with her crew because, you know, they're kind of outside the loop on this. She's gone, as you said, in the Gnostic mode. She knows something the rest of the crew doesn't. So it creates a certain tension there. But there's also a tension that is created with Seven of Nine, who is in the loop, but they see this knowledge in two different ways. There are two very different perspectives, what this means to each of them. And so there's a tremendous amount of tension that exists between the two of them.
Well, I mean, for Captain Janeway, it's a dangerous truth, right? If this knowledge gets out, then it's, you know, we could eliminate the universe or something catastrophic. I forget what exactly happens.
Yeah.
It's super dangerous. So we
but
have
the
to
Seven of Nine,
secret.
This is sacred.
Yeah, it's more transcendent. It's a special. It has more of a religious quality. It's more
right.
like. It's more like the Pythagoreans and their knowledge of mathematics. You know, mm-hmm. It's something mystical for her. And actually, this is a really interesting segue into distinguishing between different kinds of esoteric writing or esoteric thinking or esoteric practices. In the book that I'm reading, which again I haven't finished, but I have every intention of finishing it. It's a fascinating book. Again, just for reference for people who are listening, it's Philosophy Between the Lines: The Lost History of Esoteric Writing by Arthur Meltzer. He makes a really interesting distinction between four different kinds of esotericism, four different purposes for which any given philosopher might be saying one thing and meaning something different or having some sort of secret knowledge. And so what I thought it would be fun to do is go through these four types of esotericism, which are pretty easy to understand. The fourth one's a little quirky, but generally I think people will get the point, and see if we can find examples of each of these in Star Trek. And I think we actually just mentioned two, so we'll see if we can find even more. But so I'm gonna give them real quick. The first one is defensive esotericism. So you do it for your own protection, fear of persecution. Like if people find out something you're really doing or really believing, you're going to be persecuted. You're going to be put on trial. You're going to be punished. You're going to be executed. You're going to be ostracized. So you hide your secrets to protect yourself. I think that's the easiest one to understand. Early Christians did that. Clearly, after Socrates was executed, Plato had every reason to do that, right?
Yeah.
So it's dangerous to be a philosopher. And I think this makes sense. If you go against the grain of your society, if you're criticizing the government, if you're criticizing people with political authority, that's inherently dangerous. They will literally kill you for it. At least in the history of the world, that's the norm, right? That's not the norm in our society so much. You know, we take for granted that we can criticize people we can say whatever we want about Trump right now. It's not going to come back to bite us, right? Mm-hmm. But that is a huge exception in the history of the world. The vast majority of the time, if you said something contrary to the public party line, you know, politically or religiously or otherwise, your life was in real jeopardy. So that in itself should get everyone reason to suspect all of the things that philosophers have to say about their governments, right, for hundreds of years. The next is protective esotericism. This is the idea, and in fact, we just mentioned this one, the idea that there are dangerous truths, that some truths are so dangerous that we have to keep them secret because they're dangerous for ourselves, for others, for our society, for our religion, for whatever. So we hide our secrets because they're dangerous. Not to protect ourselves, but because the truths themselves are dangerous truths. Kind of like, you know, maybe how to make an atomic bomb would be a good 20th century example, right? That's a dangerous truth in the mid 20th century. We don't want the Germans to figure out how to make an atomic bomb. Or in Star Trek, we don't want the Klingons to learn how to make a Genesis device would be a mm-hmm. good example of that. I think it's a dangerous kind of knowledge, so we hide it. The next one is interesting, pedagogical esotericism. The idea that actually being obscure is pedagogically helpful. It's helpful in people learning and helpful in people gaining wisdom. You could say that we use the example of Jesus and his parables. this is a perfect example of that, that actually not saying what you mean plainly is actually helpful for people getting at the core of the idea. It's actually easier to understand certain ideas through a parable than it is just to tell them plainly. Tell them plainly, they actually miss the point in some ways. So, and I think teachers do this all the time. We sort of say, well, I'm not going to give you the answer. What do you think? You know, we deflect and force the students to kind of reason their way to their own answers in a Socratic sense. That's a pedagogical technique that is the exact opposite of being direct. Right? We're actually being quite indirect in that case. So that's another form of esotericism, being deliberately obscure or deliberately vague or speaking in parables or metaphors for pedagogical reasons, for people to teach themselves or to get at some kernel of wisdom in the process. And the last one, this one's a little harder to understand, political esotericism. And the author of this book claims that it's born out of the kind of 19th, 20th century notion that we're going to rationalize the world. He makes the claim that it's a matter of harmonizing theoretical views about ideal societies and ideal form of governments with all of the practical minutiae of developing of an actual functioning society. But the goal in deflecting and the goal in obfuscating and the goal in putting on a false front and being more politically savvy and not revealing what you really, not revealing all the critical things you think of about society is all for the sake of getting people to trust you for the sake of political power. Now, what you're really doing is gathering up political power and clout for yourself so you can change society, so you can be a bit closer to that ideal society, but you have to kind of manipulate and maneuver to gather enough political power to make an actual change in your society. And you don't do that by being critical. You do that by winning friends and influencing people. So that's his four. Defensive esotericism, which is fear of prosecution, protective esotericism or dangerous truths, pedagogical esotericism, being obscure for the sake of teaching and learning and wisdom, or political esotericism, being obscure or putting on a false front for the sake of gathering political power so you can make society in the image you want. So my question is, can we find examples of each of these in Star Trek? And let's see what comes up. So let's start with defensive esotericism. Is there anyone in Star Trek, anyone at all, any race, any member of the Federation, any officer, any peon down on deck 42, you know, who is afraid to say what they really think or really believe or what their core values are, even when they have to speak in public? You're not getting the straight scoop for their own self-preservation.
Well, there's an interesting example that came to mind for me, Zachary, and it comes from the TNG episode, The Drumhead. As this witch hunt of sorts is going on, which I'll get back to witch hunts in just a moment, because I think that's a really good example just from history. But you know, there's a witch hunt going on of sorts. And it kind of at the climax of this, we find out that this low-level, supposedly Vulcan ensign has more or less hidden the fact that he has an ancestor, a grandfather, who is Romulan.
Ooh, that's a great example, because Simon Tarsis, his paternal grandfather, if memory serves, was Romulan, and he's claiming to be full-blooded Vulcan because that is acceptable in Federation society. And this speaks to the heart of the hypocrisy of Federation society, right? Federation society is supposed to be free of prejudice, open, tolerant, and here comes this you know, mostly Vulcan, but one quarter Romulan officer who's afraid to reveal his true heritage because he fears he's going to be punished. He's going to be kicked out of Starfleet. He's not going to be trusted with Federation secrets because he might be a spy or might have some family ties to the Romulans. So undoubtedly, I think Simon Tarsis is probably committed to the idea that being a Romulan or being a Vulcan doesn't matter. They were both part of his family, probably loved his Romulan grandfather as far as we know, probably really is committed to this free and open idea that race really doesn't matter, no intolerance, no prejudice, let's accept the Romulans, let's move past our differences. If anyone is committed to that view, it's probably Simon Tarsis, right? But he's not able to say that publicly because...
Correct.
He's one quarter Romulan, and Federation society is not going to like that. As tolerant as Federation society claims to be, which itself is a kind of hypocrisy and putting on a false mask. So what's interesting is there's kind of an exchange of falsity, an exchange of not hypocrisy maybe, but an economy of false truths here, or fake truths. Simon Tarsis is lying, right? He's he's one quarter Romulan. He doesn't feel like he's entitled to say that. He's hiding his own views. He's hiding his own parentage. He's, doesn't feel free to really express his political views. On the flip side, Federation society is saying, we're free, we're open, we're tolerant, right. We want to make peace with the Romulans, we want to, homogenize the galaxy and make it safe for everyone, and we all want to be friends, and we want to learn from each other, but we're going to judge anyone who's a Romulan. So both sides of that economy are putting up a false front. And I would say, according to this author, and I think to any of us, if that doesn't count as esotericism, what does? No one is speaking the truth in this situation. Simon Tarsus is talking out of one side of his mouth while saying something different in private. And so is the Federation. It's not like the Federation isn't doing the same thing. Both parties
are doing it. And it's a little less interesting, but I think it's related to the example of the drumhead, and that is our favorite frontier physician, Julian Bashir, who is hiding the fact that he is genetically altered because him and his parents, for that matter, could be considered criminals in the Federation for having done so.
See, I knew you'd be good at coming up with these examples. I didn't think of that one. So so certainly Dr. Bashir is afraid of persecution and prosecution in his case, right?
Yes, indeed.
Persecution and prosecution, or both. Actually, he's kind of an interesting hybrid example. He's a good segue into the next one. We can probably find more examples of these, and we should continue to brainstorm and find as many as we can. But this is actually kind of dangerous truth too, right? We don't want it to be known that we don't, in Federation society, they don't want eugenics to become the norm, right? This notion that you can genetically engineer a human is itself a dangerous truth. That if that becomes the norm, if that becomes part of the vernacular of science and accepted by the scientific community and by the culture at large, you might end up with a situation like you had with Khan Noonien Singh. So that's something you want to squash and contain and prevent. And that yes, he's in danger of being prosecuted, but I would say the thing that's being hidden is itself a kind of dangerous truth. It falls in category number two.
Yeah, for sure. I think that is a perfect kind of hybrid situation.
And I think that's what's interesting, too, is in reading this book, the author is basically claiming that in many cases, a lot of these things are at play at the same time. So and given that, if philosopher by philosopher, or in Star Trek, if Federation officer by Federation officer, or empire by empire, or race by race, or religion by religion in Star Trek, if all of these things are at play, how are we justified in taking our relatively open modern view of knowledge, that modern is free and public and accessible and people are straight shooters when they write something? We're not justified at all in writing that back into the history of philosophy. We need to remind ourselves that esotericism, speaking falsely, saying one thing and believing another, or putting on a false public facing account of your philosophy and holding on to the private account of your own philosophy for yourselves or for your own philosophical group, that's actually more the norm. And we're this author is making a really interesting claim that we're not justified at all in looking at the history of philosophy through those modern lenses, that we've forgotten what it's like to be a philosopher in the history of the world in our modern times. But I think we're doing the same thing with Star Trek, right? We're looking at Star Trek and sort of, how could Star Trek be anything other than utopian and other than free and open information and anything other than progressive? But when you start to peel back the layers, you realize that even at its core, officer by officer and race by race and encounter by encounter and, sort of item by item in Federation belief system, it sure looks like a lot more of these things are at play than we'd like to think if the Federation is really based on free and open information, where there's not some sort of danger or some sort of false front put up about what Federation officers
really
believe.
And we gave several examples of dangerous truth as we were kind of moving into the topic. The Omega molecule, for instance, was one example of a dangerous truth. Of course, just about any,
the Genesis device, I think that's another one.
Yeah, the Genesis device is another great one. And of course, we talked about warp technology and so on as the Federation goes out and they are interacting with less developed species. Every time they set up a duck blind, every time they disguise themselves to get kind of up close and personal with a lesser developed species, really in many ways they're protecting what they consider to be dangerous knowledge.
In the history of philosophy, any of the philosophical groups that held on to knowledge tightly. The Pythagoreans, I think, are the best example, but you might say Platonists, definitely Neoplatonists and Gnostics. But I think in the history of modern political philosophy, you can find this too. I think they're also committed to the view that that kind of knowledge is actually more dangerous in the hands of someone who's not prepared for it. Mm-hmm. If you open the doors to philosophical thought to someone who's not prepared to actually use their reason and use rationality and prepared to kind of think through the consequences of their beliefs, that actually becomes a dangerous tool in and of itself, because mm-hmm. they're going to damage their society more, or they're going to damage their own lives more, because they're not prepared to think through the logical consequences of what they do. They're not prepared to deal with philosophy rationally and deal with it responsibly. It's yeah. actually kind of a dangerous power. You can hurt yourself. You can hurt your society. You can hurt other people. Philosophy itself is dangerous. And I think that that's at the heart of these sort of secretive groups of philosophy where there's clearly an insider and an outsider club at play.
Nitroglycerin in the hands of a Neanderthal.
Yes, that's it exactly. You know, philosophy is the nitroglycerin, and you know, the masses, the you know, the jury that executed Socrates, and all the sophists and all of the lay people who just can't seem to think philosophically, they can't handle it. So we need to kind of preserve and protect it. Yes, we do it amongst ourselves. Yes, it's important, but we definitely don't write it down, and we definitely don't advertise that that's what we're doing, right? It's dangerous to ourselves, but it's also dangerous for society as a whole. And I guess, you know, you could say the same thing about Federation society at large. Like, if you say, if we just, handed over Federation technology to a primitive, this is the prime directive, but if you just hand over Federation technology to a primitive society, they're going to damage themselves with it. They're going to start killing each other. They're not so socially prepared and politically prepared to deal with that. Same thing, I imagine what would happen if, a society that wasn't politically ready, a planet where there were still nation states warring with each other. And the Federation said, you know, we really need new members, especially after the Dominion War. So we're going to let you in, you know, mm-hmm. no matter what, you know, what do you think the consequences of that on that world would probably be? Or maybe in Federation society too, but definitely on that world.
Yeah, catastrophic for sure. I mean, there's a certain responsibility that comes with having knowledge. And, if they're not ready to handle that responsibility, there can be catastrophic consequences.
And there were. I mean, you know, in the even in universe in Star Trek, as, as humans started exploring the galaxy, they kept encountering empires, mm-hmm. right? They'd run into the Klingon Empire and there'd be a war.
Yeah.
And you could say plausibly that the Vulcans were correct in saying that humans were unprepared for the reality of the galaxy that they were about to encounter and all of its political machinations and power relationships. And mm-hmm. but, you know, and it's an interesting tension between being kind of a force for good, right? And humans always kind of think of themselves as the good guys. We're out there on the frontier, taming the Indians and, you know, making civilized people out of the uncivilized wild men, right? And undoubtedly, that's what's going on in Star Trek too. We're the good guys. We're out there, you know. We've got an enlightened political system, and we have technology that can help. So we've got all this stuff. So of course, we're going to go out the galaxy and be a shining beacon on the hill, as President Reagan might have said. But the Vulcans are saying, no. You're actually going to make things much, much worse. You're gonna poke the dragon of the Klingon Empire. Mm-hmm. You're gonna encounter diseases you never encountered. All this bad stuff is going to happen because you're out there trying to be open and free and naive about it. So the Vulcans desperately want to squash humans' effort to get out there in the galaxy, maybe partially for their own self-preservation. You know, the Vulcans definitely aren't prepared to handle an unstabilized or destabilized Alpha Quadrant, for example, right? So the Vulcans, from the Vulcans' point of view, humans are the destabilizing element, changing the balance of power and, running the risk of poking the dragon of the various empires that it encounters along the way.
Well, I think we recognize in the Star Trek universe this interesting tension that exists in humanity, or within humanity, I should say. This idea that on the one hand, we put out there in the universe knowledge about ourselves as a species, with the assumption that the beings out there, presumably, that would encounter this knowledge that we're pumping out, that they are benevolent and that they are excited and interested in the free and open exchange of knowledge. So I think there's this that interesting naivety among humanity, and I think we see that in the Star Trek universe. And again, especially in the series Enterprise, they talk about it actually quite a bit. But there's also this unfortunate reality that oftentimes we try to kill what we don't understand. And
you know, Mike, you'll probably remember the episode title, hopefully. But do you remember that episode of Enterprise where Captain Archer has to do this weird apology ritual about the trees? Like he's got to dance and he's got to saw the trees the right way and arrange the you know slabs of tree in the right way.
Because Porthos peed on a tree.
Yeah, he's being incredibly diplomatic, doing this incredibly stupid ritual, and he knows he has to, and he doesn't want to do it. And the second he's done, he's proud of himself for doing it, but he's kind of rolling his eyes along the way, But it's a very false front. It's very diplomatic, and I guess this is the thing any ambassador has to do in general. I think if you're an ambassador, of course you have to do this. You have to win favor by playing the game of the other society, right? How could it be otherwise? Captain Archer has to do, every time Captain Picard has to be an ambassador, he has to learn to play nicely and kind of incorporate himself into the belief system of the people he's negotiating with. Otherwise, he's going to be radically ineffective as an ambassador. But all of this is for the sake of gaining trust and building political clout, right? I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this is the fourth category of esotericism. When Captain Archer does his ritual, it's a very public thing. He's out there on display. It's public. He's saying things. He's doing certain activities. He's doing the ritual. So that's the public view. But the private view is, this is the dumbest thing I've ever had to do in my life. And that's the real Captain Archer, who thinks that even though it's good to have some, to build relationships with these alien cultures, and even though we need some technology from them, this is stupid. And I still want to roll my eyes about it. And same thing with Captain Picard, I think. He knows very intentionally that he has to play the game in order to be an effective diplomat. Yeah. And Riker's very good at this, actually, almost better than Captain Picard. Riker's he puts on a better kind of public face than even poker face about it than Captain Picard.
Yeah, he knows.
It's a game of poker.
It is.
But it's all for the sake of gaining trust, building relationships, so you can end up with the political end that you want. So you can get your technology, so you can make your quadrant a little more secure, so you can promote your, the political views about society that the Federation has. But the things that are said and the things that are done aren't necessarily in line with that, and they definitely seem to conflict with these inner beliefs that they have.
And that, that's interesting. The Cretaceans are this really interesting.
Yeah, I'm so glad you remember the details.
The Cretaceans are this really interesting species, and it brings to mind something. Actually, I learned in a philosophy class, and it was this little ditty here: "Seek first to understand, and then to be understood." The problem that we have with the Cretaceans is we want them to understand us. We want to get to know them, but only so far as we enlighten their society with our knowledge. But what Archer fails to do is try to understand them first. And so even just eating, putting food in your mouth with your hand is offensive to them. And we didn't know that going in. And so we offend them. We sent them the bioinformation for Porthos in the episode. By the way, for our listeners, that episode is A Night in Sick Bay. We send them the bioinformation on Porthos. And we thought we were doing our due diligence, but Archer quickly found out that, a dog going out and going where no dog has gone before on their sacred tree caused an offense. And so, Archer's got to play the game.
You know, Mike, you and I think have kind of unique insight into this category of political esotericism, because I think we had to do this. You worked at Radio Shack and I worked at Radio Shack a long time ago, and we learned sales techniques. And one of the things you learn in sales is that you learn to kind of meet people where they're at, right? You learn what their needs are. You learn, what problem they're trying to solve. You kind of build trust with them, but your end goal is to sell them something. let's not pretend otherwise, right? And I think this is the heart of category number four here, political esotericism. All of this dialogue about building relationships, about gaining trust, about doing the rituals, the things we say, the things we do, the exchange of ideas and the exchange of technology and the kind of utopian quality of Star Trek society. Ultimately, you could say, again, if you're a little cynical, if you think that this is a bit of a false front, you could say that the ultimate goal is finally to change the societies that you're talking with. You want them to join the Federation. You want them to evolve and progress. You don't really want to respect them just as they are. You want to change them. And that, you know, if you look at all of Federation society in that light, every time they make a first contact situation, the goal is not to say hi and leave. the goal was to develop a relationship with those communities. Why? So they'll progress. In other words, so they'll be different than they are because you have some vision about what you think their society should be like. It's very normative, actually. You think of Star Trek as kind of tolerant and open and respecting every society on its own terms. But the vast majority of the time, the Federation is hegemonic, right? They go to a society and they say, you know, you should join us because we're evolved and we have this enlightened political system that either you're allowed to join right now, so join us, or you're not allowed to join yet, so change and get to the point where you're ready to join us and then you can join us.
Well, that was the kind of the whole premise of Deep Space Nine. In that case, it was Bajor. You know, we had to get them ready so that they could join the Federation.
Yes, exactly. But the way you do that is to build trust, to respect their culture, respect their society, respect their beliefs, build relationships with them, you know, have the Kai over for dinner, you know, woo them in a little bit, you know, go to Quark's for some dinner, you know,
or take the Kai to a planet, get her killed.
Right. Exactly. But all of these things that are seemingly positive and seemingly relationship building, I guess you know, again, we're kind of running with the thesis of this book I'm reading, is that you can look at all of those in this as a type of esotericism. It's a way of undermining the legitimacy or undermining the sincerity of all of the beliefs and practices and all of the things that are said and all of the things that go into wooing and building that interstellar relationship with whatever society you're trying to woo. Because the end goal is to change them. You want them to join the Federation or whatnot. I think you're right. I think, you know, the Federation's relationship to Bajor is a perfect example of this. The Federation had to play nice with Bajor. They needed Bajor. But in order to get Bajor, they had to talk a certain way, act a certain way, build relationships a certain way, respect religious beliefs a certain way. And if they didn't do all of that, they were going to lose Bajor. So yes, they were ostensibly playing nice and having dinner and being diplomatic and, you know, trying to talk about the way that Bajorans wouldn't lose their culture, just like they lost their culture to the Cardassians. But ultimately, the message was, we need you in the Federation.
And interestingly enough, Bajor kept pushing against that. They didn't want the Federation. This is Bajor's sandbox, and we don't want the Federation in it. So take your toys and go home.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, an interesting question is, does this, I don't know quite how to ask it, but is this a genuine type of esotericism? You know, is the Federation upfront and direct about what they want? You know, we want you to join the Federation, and we're not being secretive about it. We're not putting on a false front. We don't have any ulterior motives. We're telling you what we want. You know, that's not esotericism. Having a goal doesn't make you esoteric. It's when you say one thing but mean something else, or you're obfuscating, or there's a hidden agenda, or some greater mismatch than that. I think, you know, just not getting what you want doesn't make you esoteric. You know, if Plato said, I think society should be like the society I described in the Republic, and I mean it, and society doesn't want to go there, that doesn't make Plato esoteric, right? What makes Plato esoteric is that if there were nods to in Plato's Republic, to things that people would find socially acceptable in Greek society at large, for the sake of wooing them in and making them friendlier to Plato's ideas, so Plato can then be utopian and convince them to build a better society, that's different, because that means not everything Plato wrote is what he really believes. He's putting things in as a kind of tokenism to woo people in and get some political clout as a result. Arguably, you could say Aristotle did this whenever he talked about the Greek gods, right? Every time Aristotle says, oh, yeah, we need the Greek gods. Like, did Aristotle really think that? Probably not. Not coming from Plato and not, you know, being an intellectual descendant of Socrates. Undoubtedly, Aristotle thought that the Greek gods were so much nonsense, just like Plato did and just like Socrates did, right? But when Aristotle talks about politics, then, you know, religion and the Greek gods serve this function in society that we need. That's a way of making his ideas friendlier to the people he's talking to, ultimately so he can move past it and convince them that there's a better way to think about religion and society and politics and whatnot. That's more like esotericism. That's saying one thing but meaning the opposite.
For instance, winning the Dominion War That's a goal, and I you know, they put that out there, and that's certainly
like wars often do. That unified everyone and got, you know, that got the
absolutely.
Job done.
Yeah. But you know, killing a Romulan senator, that was esoteric.
Esoteric murder. So what I want to move now to, I want to talk about category number three and see if we can find any examples of this in Star Trek. I have one. I'm curious if you have any others. So pedagogical esotericism, just like Jesus's parables, just like Socratic questioning, is there any example of pedagogical value in unclarity or obscurity or obfuscation in the learning process anywhere in the Star Trek universe? Like I said, I've got one, only one. Curious if you have any.
I think in a broad sense, there are a couple of examples here, and I might be conflating this a little bit, but I think in a very broad sense, I think Q is a great representation of this. I also think the Traveler is an interesting example of this in the Star Trek universe.
Ooh, interesting.
So the Traveler, the thing that's interesting about the Traveler is there's obviously knowledge there that the Traveler has that he's not exactly willing to share with humanity, although he sees some spark of interest in Wesley Crusher that makes him believe that he can entrust him with this knowledge, and Wesley can then evolve and become a part of this base.
This is an interesting hybrid between category two and category number three. It's protective esotericism. The Traveler is not sharing his special Traveler knowledge with everyone on the Enterprise, probably because it's a little dangerous, maybe for their own protection. They're not prepared to handle it. So there's a little kernel of dangerous truth that we don't know what it is, right? The Traveler never says, really. But it's definitely pedagogical. It's not that you want to hide it from everyone forever. You want to help humanity rise to the point where people can understand this special Traveler knowledge or Traveler-like abilities they have. And he sees the kernel of that in Wesley. So the Traveler takes it upon himself to kind of guide Wesley into reaching this higher plane of whatever that the Traveler has. You know, it's all very mystical and hand-wavy. We don't know what it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, it might be a better example of just mysticism itself. But
no, but it's pedagogical because he really thinks he can guide Wesley. He is the guide that's guiding Wesley into understanding this ability that he has, this nascent ability that presumably all humans have, but Wesley's tapped into for some reason.
Yeah, certainly, and that's why I mentioned it. I thought that sort of discipleship model was fascinating.
Are there any other kind of sort of mentor disciple models that fall in this category where? The Traveler is just basically kind of saying, he's not giving the straight scoop to everyone on the Enterprise. Although he does confide in Captain Picard that he sees something special in Wesley. He doesn't really explain what it is. He's not clarifying. He's not giving you a thesis on it. You know, he's not writing a treatise to explain his views, right? He's deliberately kind of hand waving with Captain Picard, although he's confiding in him in some sense.
Yeah, and he also asks Captain Picard to keep that knowledge to himself, which I think is interesting.
You know, this is a little bit of a tangent, but scholars have observed for a long time in Aristotle that there was no reason for Aristotle to write as so densely and cryptically and linguistically weirdly as he did. you know, Aristotle makes a pretty basic point in a lot of cases. So why is he so hard to read, you know, compared to Plato even? This author that I'm reading is basically saying, well, that's done for this very purpose. It's designed to keep the outsiders out, for the people who aren't prepared to deal with it. The people who can't think logically shouldn't think about logic. And the people who can are the ones who are going to be willing to put in the effort to read through this linguistic weirdness and get at the relatively simple point that he's trying to make about the nature of logic. Say in Posterior Analytics, for example, where Aristotle starts talking about, scientific induction and whatnot. You know, it's not terribly hard to understand, but it's incredibly dense and cryptic to get to sort of plow your way through to understand what he's trying to get at. And philosophy teachers love this. It's our bread and butter, right? So it gives us something to talk about. But, I mean, this is kind of what you could say the same thing about the Traveler. He's speaking in vagaries and obscurities, and he's kind of, mystical over here and special powers over here. And then, yes, he tells Captain Picard, I know this special thing about reality and I see this special thing in Wesley, so don't tell anyone. But out there in the world, he's kind of speaking, And speaking cryptically, I guess, generally, I mean, when you really listen to the Traveler's words, it's very cryptic. You know, it's almost like he's speaking in aphorisms where the things he says is like, wait a minute. Okay, that's like Jesus's parables, or that's like reading one of Nietzsche's aphorisms. It's all very like, it sounds like language, but do you mean something by it?
Yeah, yeah. I can't even compare it to a parable because the interesting thing
clear,
about parables,
right?
the parables, they're actually designed to make something that is hidden easily understood.
Except that the disciples were like idiots when they heard them. What the hell did he mean by that parable, right?
Well, that's exactly what happens. And since you mentioned it, let me kind of give a little background.
Well, it's an interesting theme. Like throughout the Synoptic Gospels, the disciples are really idiotic. They miss the point like crazy.
Well, the really interesting thing about this,
they were there, they heard the parables too, right?
Yeah, but again, you're dealing with 12 guys, Levi, who we know better as Matthew. Levi was really the only theologically trained of the disciples. His name Levi, his given name, indicates that he's from the tribe of Levi. So the Levites were trained theologically to serve in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that special, if we can call it, Gnostic knowledge.
Yeah, they got to carry the ark around. Who got to do that, right?
Yeah,
the Levites.
Yeah, exactly. The other guys didn't really have that. And I think it's interesting. One of the best descriptions of this kind of conversation that happens as Jesus begins to teach with parables is really laid out in the Gospel of Matthew. So Jesus is teaching in parables, which was unheard of at that time. The whole idea of popular teaching among the Jews in the first century was that the chief priests, the religious leaders of the time, they were the ones that had the special knowledge, and they didn't want to share that special knowledge except, you know, just what they had to share in order to keep the people kind of interested. And by the way, this carried over in the Christian church, because we see this in Christianity, where, you know, up until the King James Bible was, you know, we had the Septuagint was translated into English. All of a sudden we have an English translation of the Bible, but people died because the religious leaders did not want the common people to have the scriptures so that they could understand it, because they can't handle the truth.
So this is a really important distinction. So, like, and this is some of the categorical distinction between these different types of esotericism. When Jesus is giving his parables, if the purpose is pedagogical, it's not that the parables contradict what he really believes, right? They're harmonious, mm-hmm. right? The Jesus's
right.
parables didn't contradict the things he told his disciples directly
exactly.
in private, right? They were the same basic message in different language. One kind of simplified for the masses, one more complex and more nuanced maybe for the inner circle, but the same core message, right? So there's no conflict, there's no contradiction, there's no false front put up in that situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, but unlike the political situation where we're being diplomatic for the sake of lulling someone in, that's a matter of putting up a false front, right? Same thing with protective esotericism. Like, if you're just hiding truths from people, we're basically going to lie to you so you don't learn about these fundamental truths, right? We're going to lie about the Genesis device, we're going to lie about the Omega molecule, we're going to lie about whatever, right? That's very different than pedagogical esotericism. So I guess the question for me in the Star Trek universe is, when these things come up in a diplomatic situation, when Picard is negotiating with an alien race, or Archer has to do his weird apology dance with the trees, or whatever it is that more pedagogical, where the goal is to kind of educate and sort of help guide alien races into being prepared for this thing that the Federation thinks it has, this special knowledge about being what it really means to be in the interstellar community? Or is it more political, where there's false fronts and there's, you know, relationships being built for ulterior motives? I guess that's my core question. Is the Federation society mostly pedagogical? In other words, where there's no contradiction, even where there's obfuscation and, you know, and lying going on, is it still for some higher pedagogical purpose, or is it more political, where it's lying and false fronts and ulterior motives, and, you know, maybe it's both at the same time? And that's what's so fascinating, is usually all of these things are going to play at the same time. It's hard to distinguish what's what. I think, does the nobility of the Federation worldview and the Federation mindset and the Federation political system, does that make everything inherently pedagogical? Like, if you think you have this secret knowledge and you think that, you know, your mission is to kind of help society understand this secret knowledge, and you have this vision of an ideal society and you're trying to cultivate it, does that inherently make it pedagogical, or is it more that one of these other kinds of esotericism is at play where it's more like false fronts or more like protecting something dangerous or more like more fear-based, which is the major factor at play?
I got three words for you, Zachary. Geordi's pedagogical PowerPoints. I mean, that isn't that the whole purpose, to make the secret knowledge known?
I guess so. I mean, Geordi's PowerPoints are the height of clarity, right?
Exactly.
If anyone has a modern 20th century approach to education, it's Geordi. You get the simplified dumb. Well, actually, you know, it's funny you say that, because I have to do this all the time. You have to do it all the time. As a pastor, you have to do it. As a teacher, I have to do it. I can't give the straight scoop about philosophy. You can't give the straight scoop about Christianity every Sunday. You can't, right? In its totality, in its complexity, in its nuances, in its in all of the things that are important but not the fundamental things, you can't pack all that into every Sunday. I can't pack that into a semester, right? I definitely can't do it on day one of a philosophy class. You can't do it for the new person who's coming to your church for the first time, has never been in a church before. You can't approach it that way. You have to obfuscate. You have to simplify. You have to bracket things. You have to say, this is important, but we're not going to talk about that. You know, you have to give a simplified version for the newcomer, for the initiate, right? Philosophy is like that. Religion is like that. Politics is probably like that. Diplomacy is like that. What's it like to be part? Yeah, I can picture, you know, the Federation shows up on Bajor's door one day and says, we think you should join us. You would benefit. You would keep the Cardassians at bay. We would benefit because we get the wormhole and blah, 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 blah. And the Bajorans say, well, what's it like to be a member of the Federation? I want to hear the whole story, right? Do you think they're going to give the straight scoop about Section 31 and all of the, and the war with the Klingon Empire and all the times the Federation just, you know, effed things up? No, right? They're going to get the simplified, you know, Sunday school version of the Federation. How could it be otherwise? You can't start there, you know. But I guess my point is, that's not necessarily for ulterior motives. It's not lying. It's not deceitful. It's not fear-based. It's just recognizing the fact that for an initiate to anything new needs to kind of ease their way into greater understanding.
Yeah,
and that's not false. That's not lying. That's not esotericism. Yeah. You know, it's not like Aristotle saying. Actually, it'd almost be like if Socrates, you know, said, "Oh yeah, I really believe in the Greek gods, but over here I really don't." You know, I mean, just that's just outright contradicting yourself. I don't think that Sunday school is like that, and I don't think that diplomacy is like that, and I don't think that teaching, you know, philosophy 101 is like that. I'm not saying anything false, but undoubtedly, day to day, I give my students the simplified version of Plato and the simplified version of Aristotle and the simplified version of Descartes. And, you know, if I started with, let me pack in as much complexity about those things as possible, I would lose them all, right? And if the Federation showed up with all of its baggage to Bajor and said, here's the straight scoop about every nuance of the Federation, every time the Federation has broken the Prime Directive, you know, Bajor would run screaming, right? You can't approach it that way. But it's not lying. It's not trying to be two-faced.
No, but this exists in the Star Trek universe and exists in our own world, this idea of holding on to knowledge to some degree in order to manipulate it and, by extension, control the masses. So what Jesus was so unique and why it raised questions among the disciples is, in the first century, no one was – I do it every Sunday. You mentioned my role as a pastor, your role as a teacher. We're used to this. We're used to taking these complex ideas and explaining it with pop culture. I preach Star Trek sermons. I mean, I was dropping Star Trek references this past Sunday in my church. To bring these complicated ideas into a mindset and a thought process and a language that people understood. And that's the whole purpose of the parables. No one was doing it at the time. The disciples are saying, hey, why are you doing this? What are you doing? And Jesus says to them, listen, it's been given for you to know the secrets of the kingdom. But to them, it's not been given. So I teach them in a way that they can understand.
And I think this is a really important point. You know, if you're writing something for publication in your church, if you're writing a newsletter, if you're writing whatnot, it's going to be worded a certain way. It's going to use certain terminology. It's going to leave out certain terminology. You know, on the one hand, you can go, wait a minute, that's kind of a false front, isn't it? You know, don't you have different kinds of conversations in private on your podcast? Don't you talk about different kind of stuff, right? You can read this two ways. You can say, this is really a bifurcated life where you have, you know, this public front face you're putting on, but in private or in other context, you act a different way and it's hypocritical in some way. But you could also read it as pedagogically, as not a contradiction, is you're giving the simplified version, but you're holding back on the nuances of life and beliefs and the complexities and the other things you're interested in and, you know, the totality of your overall experience for some very intentional pedagogical purpose on Sundays, you know, I think, or in your newsletters or whatnot, right? I think there's just two very different ways you could read that situation, that any pastor or any teacher or any politician, anyone in any public context whatsoever has to face.
And the thing that I find fascinating, and again, it exists in the Star Trek universe, is this idea of performative expressions of knowledge. For the Klingons, it might be the pain, you know, going down a line and getting nailed with pain sticks. I mean, it's just this kind of performative conveying of knowledge that we see in other
Something simple might be the Klingon tea ceremony, right? Dr. Pulaski is like, wow, you want to have the Klingon tea ceremony with me? I've only read about this in books, right? You know, a human needs to do this. That's a kind of esoteric, you know, it's not terribly deep. It's just a tea ceremony, but we don't know the mystical, the mysticism that goes along with the Klingon tea ceremony. We just see Worf drinking tea, but we don't know what it really means to him and how it incorporates in Klingon's overall belief system. And Pulaski humans in general are the outsider. They're not allowed to participate in the pain stick ceremony. They're not allowed to participate in the tea ceremony. Klingons definitely have their insider only activities. We don't really know what they mean, but they presumably mean something, right?
That's a great connection.
Yeah, but any of these, like, it's almost like it is like the Freemasons and all of their rituals, right? If you're not part of the club, you don't get to play along. You don't get to participate.
Right, exactly.
You can read about them in a book that someone wrote to try to convince you what they're about, or hide what we're really doing, right? One or the other. But you don't get to play along, and so it's really special when Pulaski gets to be part of the insider group, with Worf one-on-one, or when Worf's friends do the pain stick ceremony with him on his anniversary of his age of ascension ceremony.
Right. Yeah. Great example.
So Klingons are Gnostic in their ritualism.
So Zachary, you mentioned the Freemasons, and I think that's a great segue in to talk a little bit about secret societies in Star Trek. We have secret societies in our world. Again, you mentioned the Freemasons, the Hermeticism comes to mind.
Rosicrucians come to mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Kabbalah, so on and so forth. These are all examples of esoteric groups that exist in our world. I'm wondering, what kind of esoteric groups can we find, secret societies can we find in the Star Trek universe?
Well, it's interesting because some of them are truly secretive, where you don't even know they exist. Like Section 31 is more like mythology, Federation mythology. Is Section 31 real? You know, we've heard about it, but maybe it's a myth. We don't actually know if it's real. That's how it's presented in Deep Space Nine, at least, right?
Right.
So, I mean, clearly it exists. But, you know, by the end of Deep Space Nine, we see that. So, I mean, on the one hand, that's a secret society, but is it esoteric? I mean, for me, esotericism is more like this public versus private dichotomy. You know, like, people know about the Freemasons. There are writings about Freemasonry. Some of them were written by Freemasons. Sometimes they're written by people who weren't Freemasons. But there's always kind of this question, like, wait a minute, if you're on the outside, do you really understand what Freemasons do in their rituals if only the insiders get to do it and they're not going to talk about it openly? Or if they do, they're going to hand wave and they're going to present it in a different light, or they're going to say, oh, it's just charity, or it's just whatever, right? So, you know, you never really know if you can take what they're saying seriously. That's what makes them so fascinating, because if you're on the outside, you're always on the outside. You can never really know what it's like to be an insider, because even the insiders might be lying to you about it, even if they talk about it, right? You just don't know. And same thing with Section 31. I guess I'm not convinced Section 31 is esoteric, just because there's not much dialogue about it. You know, it's not like anyone in Section 31 is saying, oh yeah, it exists and here's what we're all about. And then, you know, the question never comes up, because it's always someone else writing about Section 31 or talking about Section 31.
Oh, I think I've got the perfect example, though, and it just hit me. In Picard, Zot Vash.
Yeah, that's a great one. Exactly. There's definitely you're an insider or you're an outsider. And
yeah. Very secret society. They pass down a very carefully protected Gnostic knowledge.
Which Picard seems to know a lot about.
Yeah, he does.
For an outsider.
But I think it's interesting that he's got in his employ two former members of the Tal Shiar.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a little bit of this on camera. We see them sharing with him what little they know about Zot Vash.
Well, okay, I want to kind of run this esotericism test on these. I think the Tal Shiar is a good one because everyone knows about it, first of all, so there's no question that it doesn't exist. It's been talked about for quite a long time, so we at least have some large body of knowledge to draw from here about it. Fairly large number of references. I think it's just a good test case, right? So let's go down the list. The Tal Shiar, do they engage in defensive esotericism? Fear of themselves being persecuted? Members of the Tal Shiar. I don't think that's clear at all.
No.
Right?
No.
They're in control, right? They're the ones pulling the strings. They're not worried about their own lives being taken, right?
Yeah, most people are in fear, or live in fear of the Tal Shiar persecuting them.
Right, exactly. So I think they definitely don't seem to pass test number one here. Right. Test number two, protective esotericism. Does the Tal Shiar hide dangerous truths?
Yes, definitely.
What are the dangerous truths that the Tal Shiar hides?
Well, we never really know for sure. I think most of them are state secrets. I think certainly there's some technology that they're hiding for sure. And we see some examples of that in Star Trek, where they have technology. In fact, Deanna Troi infiltrates the Tal Shiar for that very reason. So yes.
Okay. So they're esoteric in the sense of protectiveness, right? They're protecting their own potentially dangerous secrets, but we don't really know what those secrets are, but they're definitely not going to share them.
Yeah, not always, yeah.
Okay. How about pedagogical esotericism? Does the Tal Shiar engage in training and educating and, these teacherly or pastorly-like activities? When they speak, do they do so? Or when they speak in obscurity, or when they lie, or when they are not to be taken literally, is it for some pedagogical purpose? I think the answer is probably no. But
I think it's no. But I think a great example of that again is in Picard with this society of monks that exists and they practice absolute candor.
Yeah, but they're not Tal Shiar, right?
They're not Tal Shiar. But I think they're a great example of that more pedagogical.
Well, they're more like Buddhist monks, right? When Buddhist monks speak in vague obscurities, it's like they're putting up a mirror to you. They want you to think about it yourself. They don't want to just give you an answer. They want you to use your brain, right? So that's for a pedagogical purpose. Just like Socrates and asking his questions was all like, okay, let me use your rationality. I'm not going to answer the question for you.
Right.
So yeah, I think what is this, Zot Vash? I think they engage in pedagogical esoterism. So I don't see the Tal Shiar doing that though.
Yeah, no.
Maybe amongst themselves in the inner circle, once you're in, maybe they speak that way to train people to move up the ranks. Mm. But, that's all wildly speculative about something that's already fictional. So, do they engage in political esotericism? In other words, should we take their words skeptically? not trusting them because they have political motives.
Always.
I think yes, definitely. So it seems like, the Tal Shiar are esoteric in two senses. They protect their dangerous truths and they have political aims. This is a good test case. I think we could run all of these. Okay, so how about we now go to something like, we kind of already did Section 31.
Yeah.
Do you have another one? Which other one should we run this test on? I think it's a fascinating approach.
Well, I think for fear of almost being redundant, I think the Obsidian Order is a great example. But I think there's so much similar to the Tal Shiar, it would almost be redundant.
Oh, by the way, I never got around to talking about my example for pedagogical esotericism.
Please do.
I almost forgot. The example that came to my mind was in the Voyager episode Gravity, when we see flashbacks to Tuvok being trained by an old Vulcan master who's trying to get young Tuvok to you to embrace logic, to take more control of his emotions than he's able to do. But he's incredibly, the old master is incredibly frustrating to Tuvok. Tuvok wants the straight answer, and this old Vulcan master is deflecting and speaking metaphorically and not giving him the straight answer, speaking in riddles, as young Tuvok says.
That is a great example.
The master is doing it very intentionally. You know, he's not speaking, he's not saying what he really believes, right? He's saying lots of things, but he's not saying what he really believes because he wants Tuvok to come up with the conclusions for himself. So that's my one example I came up with for pedagogical esotericism. Old Vulcan masters training young emotional Vulcans to not be young and emotional anymore.
Very good. That's a great example. That is a fantastic example.
So yeah, we could do the Obsidian Order. So I suspect that it might be the same. What I'm really curious about, because I think the Obsidian Order is largely analogous to the Tal Shiar, right? I mean, is there any disanalogy there that you can think of?
The only difference that I could possibly, the only distinction I could make, perhaps with the Obsidian Order is I do think that there is within it the potential for these discipleships. I think we see it with Garrick, mm-hmm. and Aubryn Tain.
Mm-hmm.
But that may exist strictly because that's a father and son relationship.
Well, okay, you mentioned the Q Continuum, and that's not really a secret society, but it might as well be. You're either a Q or you're not, right? So
Yeah.
So how about defensive esotericism? Does the Q engage in defensive? Are the Q afraid of being persecuted? Yes.
Yeah.
One of them was afraid of being punished by the Q Continuum. In fact, Q has been punished by the Q Continuum, and Quinn has been in danger of being punished by the Q Continuum. So yes, Q are very afraid of persecution. In fact, Quinn says he's not afraid to speak. He's not able to speak his mind freely. Right? The society is too hegemonic and too intolerant for him to be the free thinker that he is.
Yeah.
So the Q are definitely, they engage in esoteric behavior. All the things that, in fact, Quinn was, this is fascinating, actually. I'm just now making this connection on the fly, but Quinn was known as the Q Continuum's greatest philosopher. And there's also an image in, maybe we should use this as the thumbnail for the episode, but there's an image in one of the episodes in the episode Death Wish, where it shows like a newspaper clipping written by Quinn, right? That's his public propaganda, but he's not free to say what he really thinks, right? He has to, he's publishing something for general consumption by the Q Continuum, being subversive in the process, trying to lull them in, definitely trying to change society, but he doesn't feel free to say what he really thinks because he's going to be punished and imprisoned in a comet.
Yeah.
So definitely the Q are highly esoteric here, and they meet criterion number one.
They're
Q-soteric. Or do they engage in protective esotericism? Do the Q protect their own dangerous truths?
Yes.
I think so. They don't just tell humanity the straight scoop. In fact, he basically says as much to Picard at the end of The Next Generation, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's pedagogical for that very reason, right? You could read all of Q's activity in the course of The Next Generation as a pedagogical process, trying to raise the kind of like the Traveler in that. It's trying to raise the awareness of Captain Picard in particular, and maybe humanity as a whole, so they can be on this great adventure of exploring the nature of existence versus mapping star systems and plotting nebula, right? Whatever the phrase is that Q uses at the end of Next Generation. But that's for a pedagogical purpose. That's to sort of guide humanity into being more Q-like.
Yeah, I was going to say, most Q episodes really consist of Q playing with humanity to some degree for the purpose of helping them discover something about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think definitely that qualifies.
Okay, so far they've met three of our four criteria here. Any one of these is enough to be esoteric, right? So these are four different ways of being esoteric.
Q-soteric.
The Q are Q-soteric in three out of four. Now, how about political esotericism? I'm trying to think how to phrase this even about the Q. Do the Q engage diplomatically or say things they don't really believe for some higher political aim that they have?
Beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I think the imagery that's used in the Q and the Gray is probably the best example of that. We have two very different schools of thought that exist within the Q, And how that gets played out in their interactions with the galaxy, I think, certainly qualifies.
Interesting. So it sounds like, and I can't believe I didn't think of this when we were preparing for the episode, but actually of all the secretive societies in Star Trek, like the Tal Shiar only hit, you know, were only hit two of these different ways of being esoteric. And same thing with the Obsidian Order. And Section 31 barely qualifies even as esoteric. As secretive as they are, there's nothing they're saying publicly to be esoteric about, right? So, but the Q seem to engage in all of these kinds of esoteric behavior.
Yeah, and I think that perhaps if we learn a little bit more down the road about Jatvash, I think we'll find because there does seem to be a certain mysticism that exists among them. I think that there's a knowledge that they protect. There's definitely, it's a very small group. They obviously have to pass this knowledge down over time. So I think given the little bit that we know about them, I think they qualify as well. I'll be interested to see if we learn more about them later on. But the Q, I think, are definitely Q-soteric.
Times four. they meet all four different ways of being esoteric.
Well, Zachary, we're winding down here, getting near to the end of today's program. But before we do, I want to just touch on one other thing that we had in the notes that we wanted to bring up, and that is mysticism in Star Trek and how that relates to Gnosticism and esoteric knowledge.
You know, I had mysticism on the list of topics we could talk about because it's clearly related. If you have a certain mystical view and it's quasi-religious and you have beliefs and practices and a language about it and you've got followers who, you know, do mystical things with you, it's inherently Gnostic, right? There's an insider club, people who are doing the mystical activities mm-hmm. and understand the complexity of it, and there's everyone else, all the outsiders. So mysticism is inherently Gnostic and esoteric, I think. And there's the reason I think we could make a whole show out of this, there's so much of this in Star Trek. You know, there's Vulcan mysticism, and Klingons mm-hmm. have their way of being mystical, and Romulans have their way of being mystical, and the Bajorans have their way of being mystical. So really, this probably does deserve its own topic. But I think insofar, I think the clearest example we have of mysticism that falls in the category of esoteric behavior is probably the Vulcans, right?
Yeah.
In Enterprise, we see that Vulcans had to rediscover mind melds, right? This is kind of an underground practice that some Vulcans do that other Vulcans either don't do or not able to do, or that's not politically acceptable, and it's generally culturally not accepted that Vulcans do mind melds and the various things that go along with mind melds. So I guess in my mind, this makes the Vulcans, at least the Vulcans who are mystical, you know, the mind-melding Vulcans, it puts them in the first category of esotericism, right? They're yes, Vulcans exist and they have societies and they communicate with each other, but those Vulcans who can do mind melds and want to do mind melds and believe strongly that they should be able to do mind melds aren't in a position of putting that belief out there openly in Vulcan society. They have to be secretive about it. They have to language it a certain way. They can't let outsiders mm-hmm. know a certain thing. They're in danger of being punished or whatever the consequences are in Vulcan society are going to be. So Vulcan mysticism is interesting in particular because it's not out there on full display. Like Bajoran mysticism is just on full display. All the Bajorans are mystical. Yes. They all believe in the prophets. There's no problem, right? But Vulcan mind melds weren't like that, at least in the time period we see in Enterprise, right? The ability to do mind melds and all of the mystical things that go along with it were really radically suppressed by Vulcan society. So those Vulcans had to be, they were saying things, they were interacting with other Vulcans, they were interacting amongst themselves in certain ways, but they could not just put the fullness of their beliefs about mind melds and Vulcan mysticism out there for Vulcan society to see because it wasn't being accepted at the time. So again, so anything they say is through the lens of suppression, right? they don't express the fullness of their beliefs because they're not right. allowed to.
Yeah, and so you have this whole subculture within the Vulcans, the Cyrenites, who are kind of the protectors of this esoteric knowledge.
And any suppressed subculture is going to be that way because they don't feel accepted by society. So they're going to be very careful about how they language and how they message and, mm-hmm. you know, all the signals they send and, you know, every facet of communication, verbal and nonverbal, has to be very carefully constructed to be socially acceptable.
Yeah, in the first few centuries of Christianity, that's the way they existed. They had symbols and signs and special code words
exactly.
that they used to communicate with one another.
And it was very cryptic as a result. Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And even, you know, and I'm trying to think of a modern analog that's not religious or mystical. You know, a good friend of mine, a former boss of mine, is gay, and he grew up in the, you know, 60s and 70s in gay subculture. That's mm-hmm. I think that's an amazing example where, you know, it's not something that's not allowed, but all these signs and symbols and ways of expressing and subtext, all these things evolved as a way of being authentic, but in a way that is sort of not recognizable, or at least recognizable in a socially acceptable way to society at large. And he and I talked a lot about that because we talk a lot about communication. It's fascinating. I learned so much about it just from having a friend who's, you know, immersed in that radically. But I think that's probably a really clear modern example where you have a subculture that is not free to express itself. And all of this linguistic and nonverbal communicative practices evolve, none of which capture the essence of what they really believe and what their self identity is. They're all like masks in a way. You know, they're recognizable to insiders, but not to outsiders.
Because they have to suppress, right?
Exactly. And I guess from the perspective, the question that we started with at the beginning of the podcast is, you know, like in the history of philosophy, when philosophers are doing that, when they communicate with each other subtextually and, you know, being cryptic with each other and teaching each other in certain ways, does that have the same quality where it's supposed to be intentionally cryptic, keep those outsiders out, have a protective sphere where the insiders can be, have things that are sort of signs and symbols that are recognizable to the insiders, but all in a very sort of socially acceptable way, especially in light of Socrates just having been executed. And same thing in early Christianity. I think those are direct analogies, I think. And then what does that mean in Star Trek? And so anytime there's suppression in Star Trek, and maybe this is what we a different way we could have framed the discussion. If we had a part two, we could talk about this. Where is there suppression in the Star Trek universe, and how exactly does that result in these linguistic practices that are cryptic?
I think it's definitely a topic for a future episode, and I think in that same vein, I think it. I think we should have some conversation around this idea of within the Star Trek universe, how, for instance, and a great example I can think of is in Deep Space Nine, when we're talking about the Bajorans' belief, not everybody thinks that the Bajorans' belief is valid. And we have this with, you know, people and with humans and Klingon beliefs, or humans and Vulcan beliefs, or whatever the case may be. What is justified true belief, I think, is the terminology that we would in philosophy.
Actually, a really good example is Lieutenant Worf. Worf is not allowed to be fully Klingon. Mm-hmm. On the Enterprise. He's got to suppress so much about himself to get through his day. And he's very amicable about it. He doesn't seem to be holding a grudge about it. But once in a while, you get a glimpse of the real Worf. Worf will lose it once in a while, and you see the fullness of Worf that he's not allowed to have. I think that's the kind of thing I have in mind. Like, Worf's Klingonness is being suppressed, not out of any ill intention, I think. It's just he doesn't feel free to be his full self. And it manifests itself in lots of ways. Once in a while, he outbursts and he's a full Klingon. But he also has these various ways of conveying his Klingonness in a way that you know, the friendly people on the Enterprise can accept.
Yeah, yeah.
Heart of esotericism, I think. All of that linguistic minutiae you have to do to make yourself palatable when really you don't feel free to say what you really think.
For sure.
Because Worf, everyone will just tell Worf no. You know, no, Worf. You know, it's... You see that? Have you seen that video where it's on YouTube? You should find it. There's someone cut together all the times people shut down Mr. Worf after Worf,
yes,
Worf makes a
I've
suggestion.
Seen it.
No wonder he's not going to say what he really thinks. People just tell him no all the time.
But, you know, when we do have this future conversation, and I think we should definitely have this future
suppression
conversation,
and oppression in Star Trek, we should talk about
that. I think it would be interesting to weave into that this concept of justified true belief. As it relates to knowledge, I think that would be fascinating because, you know, at the end of the day, for the Vulcans, for instance, what matters is, you know, they believe what they believe, but is it justified true belief? This idea, I think it was the philosopher Edmond Gettier.
Gettier cases, yeah. These exceptions to justify
this
true belief.
This idea that knowledge must be something more than justified true belief. I think that would be kind of a fascinating thing to throw into that conversation.
Yeah, there's these, I don't remember the details of these. I'd have to reread them and remind myself of the particulars, but they go something like this. I'll give you one because they're fun right now. Like, suppose there's this guy and, you know, he has some coins and he puts some coins in his pocket. So he has this belief. I've got some coins in my pocket. It's justified. Mm-hmm. He put the coins in his pocket. It's true. There are coins in his pocket. And he believes that there are coins in his pocket. So justified true belief. But unbeknownst to him, some weird situation has arisen where there was a hole in his pocket and someone slipped some different coins, and the coins fell out and there are different coins in his pocket because someone walked by and slipped some coins in his pocket. So he still has a justified true belief, right? It's justified that there are coins in his pocket. He believes right. there are coins in his pocket. And it's true. There are coins in his pocket. Is that knowledge?
Yeah. And I think another spin on that is called, I think it's called the cow in the field. The thought experiment, sure. The cow in the field. Or the Star Trek version of that would be the Targ in the field.
You could tell that one if you want, or we could save it for next time.
We'll save it for next time.
I think it would be more when we get to this topic.
Yeah, for another time. Yeah, I think that's... We'll another time, listeners, we'll talk about the Targ in the field.
Well, we had a pretty ambitious agenda for today. We talked about esotericism, Gnosticism, esoteric writing, secret societies, and mysticism all at the same time. But these five topics aren't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm.
The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
Like you're saying about JL... I remember at the time reading this, Rafi calling him JL, and I remember that feeling weird to me, like you, the first time it was in the comic. And then I was like, JL, that's kind of casual. But like you said, she kind of talks to that. But now rereading it, when I got to that, it just makes so much sense because I'm used to it now. It just seems so natural. But at the time, it felt a little odd.
Earl Grey.
This is that McCoy is still alive. Mm-hmm. And he goes and picks up McCoy, and Scotty and McCoy have adventures throughout the galaxy in their own run.
No, then they go and find the Nexus and get Kirk back, and it's the three of them that go.
And they go to Romulus, of course, as well, to help out Spock with the reunification. Yeah.
And then they go to the Genesis planet, because obviously there's remnants of it after it blew up, and they find some Spock DNA. And they use some Borg maturation chamber to make themselves a mini Spock. But it goes wrong, so Spock is only like 6 inches tall.
Pocket yes. Spock.
And McCoy can put him in his pocket all the time.
I'd like him, but he's,
we'll call him
McCoy loves
he's
that.
Got a, he's yeah. got a wee kind of lapel pocket. Yeah, I like this, a breast pocket.
We'll call him Spocket.
Spocket. Spocket in McCoy's pocket. I like that. Okay.
Primitive Culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
That whole title sort of feels like the beginnings of what Roddenberry would do with Q. And having all those play on Q, basically. Yeah. Which I think had you had Mudd come back, you know, more... It's just almost a shame that Discovery hasn't picked up that. And when they had Harry Mudd in... Yeah, exactly. They should have done that.
They resisted the temptation for the cheap. I mean, that is, as I say, there is always a temptation with these things to go for the cheap pun. Yeah. Sometimes it's the right decision to resist. I don't know.
I think a cheap pun is the right call every time, Duncan, to be honest.
The Ready Room.
What does it mean to be artificial? And when you cross that barrier from being biological mm-hmm. to being artificial, but your memories have been transferred, how much of who you are is the memory that you acquire over the course of your life, and how much of it is the biological system of your body?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of MetaTreks, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact, choose Message to a Trek FM Show, and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, speaking of contact information, when you're not busy engaging in defensive esotericism for your own self-protection, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the TrekFM network?
Well, Zachary, certainly Facebook, that is where I'm most active. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. On Instagram, I'm cmichael1701. You're certainly welcome to connect with me on my website, cmichaelmorrison.com or hannahgoodhart.com. And Zachary, when you're not getting lost in one of Jordy's pedagogical PowerPoints, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Oh, I see you've been in my philosophy class. Philosophical Jordy PowerPoint presentations. Yes, that's what I do. Well, you can find me on many, many, many episodes of To the Journey, Trek FM's show on Star Trek Voyager, where we talk about all things related to Star Trek Voyager. You can always find me in the Babel Conference as well if you'd like to talk about Star Trek with me in there. And more, you can find me on my website blogging about all different number of things related to philosophy and literature and anything I happen to find interesting that I want to write about. I'm trying to write something every day or every other day, so feel free to find me on my website as well. It's just zacharyfruehling.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. It's just at zacharyfruehling. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, The Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcast episodes each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the most esoteric communicator I know. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And we'd also like to give a special thank you and a shout-out to our four associate producers. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin, Kay Shaw, Norman Lau, and Mark Walker. And Mike, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.